Good evening, everybody. This would be a good time to grab a Bible if you don't have one. Some people are grabbing them already over in the white bookcase. I'm sure you know that. This evening, we're going to come back to our study in Exodus. We're up to Exodus chapter 14 tonight. If you remember the story thus far, we've followed the children of Israel as they've been delivered out of Egypt. Commissioned Moses to go to Egypt to call on Pharaoh to let the children of Israel go, and how the Lord visited Egypt with 10 different plagues that he brought on them in order to force Pharaoh's hand to allow the children of Israel to leave Egypt and go and to the promised land, the land that God had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so we followed through all of those plagues, and it culminated with the plague of the death of the firstborn in Egypt, and how God spared the Israelites by instituting the Passover sacrifice, the sacrifice of the Passover. And after that was instituted, the angel of death came and took the firstborn, all the firstborn of the Egyptians, and then the Pharaoh let them go. Pharaoh allowed the children of Israel to leave, and so we saw the different commands and regulations that the Lord was putting together concerning the Passover and how they were to keep it and why they were to keep it. That's some of the things that we looked at last week, and then we saw how they went ahead and took off. They gathered together in Sukkoth, according to Exodus 13:20, and they gathered their belongings and they headed out from there. And if you remember, there was a cloud that was with them during the day. There was a pillar of fire, a column of fire that would show up at night. So they had just a constant reminder of an assurance of God's protection and God's leading in this journey that they were taking. So that's where we left off, and today we'll pick up in chapter 14 as we continue on with it. This chapter is just full of fascinating and interesting stuff, and it's just action-packed, and it's something that we could spend days on, but we'll just give a quick overview like we have been doing. And like I said, if you feel like hanging out afterwards, we're going to have a short break at the end of this study here so that people can go pick up their kids. And you can bring your kids in here if you want to hang out with the kids. It's going to be real informal. But I just want to quickly go through a couple of the different theories concerning the routes taken in the Exodus. But here in Exodus chapter 14, let's begin here with verses 1 through 4. It says here, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, that they turn and camp before these different places. You shall camp before it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, They are bewildered by the land. The wilderness has closed them in. Then I will harden Pharaoh's heart, so that he will pursue them. And I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his armies, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord." And they did so. Okay. It opens right up here with this odd thing that God has Israel do. When he has them leave, remember last time he talked about it, he wasn't going to let them go by the most common trade route, the way of Philistia, the way by the Mediterranean Sea. That was a real common trade route. It was a real easy route to take. It was a place where they would have been able to find all kinds of food and water and provisions along their way. But God didn't send them that way, and there were several different reasons for that. The Egyptians had fortresses out there, and the Philistines weren't going to be real crazy about seeing 2 million strangers come through their borderlands, so more than likely they'd be facing some real trouble if they were to do this. So God sends them this way, and here he explains where it is he's sending them, and these are places that are lost to us in antiquity, so we're not exactly sure where he's sending them, but he's sending them an odd direction. We know that much. It's a strange route that he's telling them to go. And it's away from the main highway. And from the text, we see that it looks as though God is leading the children of Israel into a trap. And we're going to see how this unfolds as it goes. But as we're reading this, and as even God has set the stage here for us in talking to Moses, the trap that's being set is not a trap set for Israel, but conversely, it's a trap that's being set for Egypt. God isn't finished with Egypt. Even after the 10 plagues, and even after Pharaoh has allowed the children of Israel to go to leave, there is still a price to be paid. There's still a reckoning to be made with God. And so it's an interesting thing what God is doing here. He's drawing Pharaoh out. He's drawing him into a trap in essence. Pharaoh thinks that Israel is confused because of the route that they're taking, because it's such an unusual route and because it's such a bizarre way for them to go when you've got so many people, 2 million people traveling, that it just doesn't make any sense for them to go that way. And so Pharaoh right away begins reasoning in his mind and thinking, hey, these guys are confused. They don't know where they're going. They don't know what they're doing. They're going to get boxed in, and we're going to be able to go get them. So in Pharaoh's mind, more than likely, gears are beginning to turn, and he's thinking, "Hey, there's some payback here. Payback time is coming. I'm going to go get these guys." So we keep reading here, verses 5-9. Now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned, against the people, that is Israel, and they said, "Why have we done this? That we have let Israel go from serving us." And so he made ready his chariot, and he took his people with him. Also he took 600 choice chariots and all the chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh the king, and he pursued the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with boldness. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them camping by the sea at these different places. Baal Zephon, and I forget how it's pronounced. It's not pronounced at all the way it's said there. Kiroth is how it's pronounced. Again, these are places that are lost to us in antiquity. All we can do is speculate on where these places may have been that he's caught them. We really don't know for certain what the route is that the Israelites were taking as they left for the promised land. But this is weird here because God is showing his sovereignty. It's weird how this opens up. It's almost like as if Pharaoh has suddenly lost his memory. You know, he's sitting there saying, and he's looking around. It's like he kind of looks around and says, "Wait a minute, why did we just let these guys go? What's going on here?" I mean, for those of us who've been following this story and reading this, we can immediately think of 10 really good reasons why he let the children of Israel go and why he came to that conclusion. But here is this strange act of God's sovereignty that there's a cloud that comes over him. It's the most bizarre thing. It smacks of something supernatural. We could talk about how the human heart has a great propensity to forget what God has done and to forget, you know, the things that we should have learned. And we can look at our own lives and think about the many times in which we've made exactly the same mistake that we've made time and time and time again and smack our forehead and say, "When am I ever going to get this straight? When am I going to learn this?" But in reality, as we're looking at this, this is too pronounced. I mean, this is intense here. There's something odd about this, that Pharaoh all of a sudden seems like he's shaking his head going, "Wait a minute, where am I? What's going on? Where are the children of Israel?" And he takes off after them. And it's something that he does here. He heads out with this huge mobile fighting force. This was advanced technology for this day and age. I mean, these chariots, this was the most advanced fighting military machine that they had. And so he gathers up not only just his regular army, but he's got all these crack commando squads too, and in fast-moving chariots that can get in on this as well. So a huge army takes off out of Egypt going after the children of Israel. And they've got all this, like I said, advanced technology and weaponry and stuff. And as we're reading this and we look at it, you know, what do the children of Israel have? It says that they've got, in verse 8, the children of Israel went out with boldness. Yeah, okay. So here comes all the tanks and the helicopters and everything like that surging in on them, but they got boldness. That's actually not that bad of a thing, really, when you think about it. I mean, this is not that bad. When it comes to the issues that we face in life, when it comes to the attacks that we oftentimes face from our enemy, I'll tell you, there's the best stuff that we can combat our enemy with is a boldness in Jesus Christ, is having a bold confidence in him, that he's in charge, that he's going to take care of us, that he is going to win the day on our behalf, that he's going to lead us through and accomplish his will. A bold confidence that he's going to do that. I can't think of any better weapon that's out there. You know, the word says, some trust in chariots, some in horses, but we'll remember the name of the Lord our God. Because as we're going to see how this story unfolds, God plus one is a huge majority. And we don't have to fear what the enemy brings against us. We don't have to fear the weapons that he brings to bear against us in our life as we go through this journey that God's placed us on in this life that we live. We don't need to fear him. We need to have a boldness in Jesus Christ that he's going to do what he said he was going to do. But of course, for Israel, their boldness only lasts just until they look behind them. We'll pick up here in verse 10. We'll read 10 through 14. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and all the boldness drained away. And behold, the Egyptians marched after them, so they were very afraid. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, and then they said to Moses, "Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is it not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, 'Let us alone, that we may save the Egyptians'? For it would have been better for us to save the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness." And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." Anyway, it says they were very afraid. The Israelites became very afraid. When they turned around, you know, they're sauntering along. Everything seems great. Everybody's having a good time. People are, you know, playing loud music and enjoying themselves. And all of a sudden, somebody just happens to look behind them and look again. And here comes this army bearing down on them. And, you know, there's a good reason to be afraid. I mean, you think about it. They got boldness. Well, they did. And the other guys have big weapons and big guns and all kinds of stuff. So, I mean, you know, you look at it. God has drawn Israel, based on this text, he's drawn them basically into a cul-de-sac. They can't go back from where they came because the Egyptian army is bearing down on them, and they can't go forward because they're by the sea and there's no route out of there for them to escape by. God's brought them into a position where they're absolutely trapped. Thanks, God, this is great. I love this plan you have for us. You can see why they were getting extremely distressed or discomfited at least. It says there that they cried out to the Lord, and that's a good thing. I mean, again, it's one of these good thing, bad thing kind of things. You know, it was good that they had boldness. It's not so good that they became very afraid. It's good that they cried out to the Lord. I mean, that's what we want to do. When trouble like that comes, when things like that are happening, man, that's what we got to do. We got to cry out to God and seek his help. And we talked about that even last Sunday, you know, being a people who are a desperate people, desperate for God and his help and him to come to our aid. But it doesn't end there, because then after they cry out to the Lord, they do that quickly, and then they start looking around for someone to blame for this, which is a very human thing to do. They start looking around and saying, "Well, wait a minute, how did we get in this situation?" It's almost like Pharaoh was thinking, "Wait a minute, why did I let those guys go?" The Israelites are like, "Wait a minute, what are we doing here?" And they look over at Moses, who's standing there still smiling, saying, "This is great, guys, we're going to go." And they're saying, "What have you done to us?" They're walking up to him, and immediately, look at how they put this conspiracy theory together. They talk to him in terms of, you know, "Why did you bring us out here?" In other words, this was your idea, wasn't it? You tried to kill us. We were having a great time in Egypt. Everything was wonderful and glorious, and you have designed a way in which you're going to destroy us. They immediately develop this conspiracy theory. There's nothing that Moses has ever said that could support this kind of a theory. There's nothing he's ever done that would indicate to them that he was against them. But that's their immediate assumption, because they're looking for someone to blame for the situation that they find themselves in. So they immediately begin assessing the intent of Moses' heart. And I'll tell you, that's probably the most dangerous thing we can ever do with one another. To sit down and begin to try to assess what we believe the intentions of another individual's heart are. We don't know that. We don't know anything but what our simple minds can perceive about another individual. We don't know what's going on in their heart. And it's a bad thing. It's a dangerous thing. Here Israel gets to the place where they're actually distorting their past. They're looking at it as though, man, Egypt was such a wonderful... They talk about it like it was a resort. "We told you, hey, leave us alone. We're having a great time. You know, we were passing around the suntan lotion, drinking margaritas. Everything was wonderful. And then you came and dragged us out here. And now we're all going to die." It's a strange thing that happens. As soon as we begin questioning the Lord like that, and then we start looking for someone to blame, someone else to blame for our immediate situations, we find ourselves in the dangerous territory of trying to discern the intent of someone else's heart. And it's a bad place to be, because once we begin doing that, once we begin going down that slippery slope of determining that we know why a person did this or that, or we know that this person or that person is against us for whatever reason, and we slide into this strange realm where we're not operating out of faith or love or loyalty for our Savior, but we're operating out of this strange sense of self-pity, that everything is against me and everyone is against me and I have no friends, and we assign that same kind of attitude to God. It's a strange pattern of behavior for us as humans, that after we've become saved and after we've committed our hearts to follow after what the Lord wants for us and what the Lord desires as a plan for our lives, when things begin to fall apart, we begin to freak out. We can't even imagine why things are going badly for us. But here we can see all the way back from the beginning. We've seen the pattern through Genesis. We see the pattern here. And in stark detail here and dramatic events here, we see that Satan never lets God's children go easily. He never just sits back and lets people go off after God's will and fulfilling his desires for their lives without some sort of a fight. That's what he does. It boggles my mind when people come to me and say, I don't understand it. I was unsaved and everything went right for me, and then I became a Christian and everything fell apart, and what's wrong? Is God mad at me, or are people being ugly to me? And I keep reminding people, no, you're exactly in the right spot. When things are falling apart and things are going bad and you're facing trouble, it's only an indication that you're going against the grain of what your enemy wants. Of course he's going to fight that. And God allows him to fight that, and God even allows us to get trapped in cul-de-sacs at times in order to be able to show his glory and his faithfulness on our behalf. We have to rest in him. We've got to trust him like Moses. Moses' response here is just awesome. All these people are running around. They're freaking out. They're like chickens running around with their heads cut off, you know, bumping into the walls and stuff, trying to figure out where they're going to go and what they're going to do. And Moses just responds, and he's so braveheart here. He just stands here and he talks to them in such peaceful faith. It's just tremendous to me. He has no idea at this point how God is going to deliver them. But he stands there in front of 2 million people who are freaking out, and he's looking at an army over their shoulders coming straight at him, and he's hearing the waves lap against the shore behind him, and he says, stand still. God's going to get us out of this. He has no clue how it's going to happen. He has no idea what the Lord's about to do, but he's confident that he's going to do it. He's got a quiet confidence and faith in God that makes him a man of heroic proportions. I love that about him. I think that's an awesome thing that we see here in Moses. You look at the way God's developed his character over time. This is not the same Moses who murdered a man in Egypt. This is not the same Moses who was so disheartened and downcast when the Israelites first rejected his call to leave Egypt, or the way the Pharaoh began to reject him. This is a different Moses altogether, because God, through all of those different events, was working on his character. That's what God's doing with us. He's working on our character. When we face these things, when we face troubles, we face trials, remember, it's not because God just is getting off on toying with the little ants down here or playing with them. It's because he's perfecting something in us. He's saying, I want you, when you get here with me, to look like me. And that's what he's doing all through these things. He's perfecting his character in us. And we sometimes submit to it and sometimes learn from it and move in that flow and sense of contentment, realizing that he's in control and he's doing things on our behalf. And sometimes we kick and we scream and we don't learn, and we're more like the Israelites than we care to admit. But it's all the same process. It's what he's doing through it all. So he basically says to these guys, you know, shut up. God's going to take care of this. And it's cool that he says, stand still. You know, it kind of gives you a picture of what was going on. He's telling them, stand still. More than likely, everybody's running around in a panic, going in little circles and stuff, and their arms waving around in the air, little dust clouds behind them and stuff. And Moses is saying to them, stand still. I like that, because You realize it's a thing about us humans. Fear will cause us to panic. Fear will cause us to run all over the place and tell us to retreat, you know. We're going in the direction God wants us to go, and then something goes wrong, and we immediately begin to panic, and we begin to fear, and we want to retreat. Go back the other way, man. Go back where it used to be safe, and it seemed to be all right. Or other ways in which panic will hit us is we'll get impatient. We look around and think, man, something's got to happen. Something's going to take place now. If it doesn't take place now, you know, I'm going to freak out. Or presumption. We'll get presumptuous sometimes. These guys could have just jumped into the Red Sea before the Lord did anything and ended up in a real disaster. But God's command was to stand still. It doesn't necessarily mean inactivity, but what it means is find that still place of confidence in who He is, in His promises, in what His Word has said. He's given us His Word. He's given us His command. He's told us how to live in this world. He's told us where we're going ultimately. And so we have to have that still confidence, even in the midst of really bad situations and circumstances, a still confidence, like Moses is displaying here, that God is going to take care of this somehow, some way. All right, let's keep reading here, verses 15 through 18. And the Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward, but lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, and the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army and his chariots and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I have gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen." Okay, so what we get from the beginning part of this text is that Moses, before the people, was brave. He's brave heart there when he's talking to them. And you're looking at a guy right now who knows exactly what this is like. He sounds brave, he sounds good, he gives them the word, and it's a good word and something they can put their confidence in. But then as soon as everybody's gone, he slides over to the side and he goes, "God, what are we going to do? How are we going to get out of this one?" He's freaking out. And obviously he's crying out to the Lord. He's brave in front of the people, but he's whining to the Lord. And the Lord rebukes him. This is an interesting thing. He said, "Why are you crying to me? Well, who else was there that I was supposed to go to, Lord? Why are you crying to me?" He says, "I want you to go out there and do something. I want you to go do something for me." Now, I think that's an interesting thing and an interesting insight about something. You know, while we want to develop prayer lives and we want to commit everything in our lives to the Lord in prayer, we want to know His will and stuff, there actually is a time when we may not be in the right position to constantly be praying about something instead of moving forward on something. Now, just hear what I'm saying in that. Sometimes I think it's characteristic of us as humans to use prayer as an excuse to delay, as a means of buying a little time before we have to face some sort of situation that we know we're going to have to face, before we have to make a decision that the Lord is calling us to make a decision about. We want to know His will. We want to find His path for us. We want to do that. But I'll tell you something. Somebody told me this a long time ago, and I think it holds very true, that a ship standing still in the water cannot have its course vectored. It's got to begin moving before the ship can actually be turned. And sometimes we've got to be careful that in an attempt to be pious about things, we don't just let ourselves get shocked into inactivity by saying, "Well, I'm going to just wait here on what the Lord is going to do. He's got to show me exactly what I got to do, and I got to get a clear word from Him." Sometimes the Lord is saying, "Hey, wait, don't just cry out to me about this. Move forward. I'm going to show you what it is I've got for you." Just like He was saying to Moses here. Sometimes we need to step out. And that's where flexibility comes in. I mean, we don't place all of our identity into the decisions that we make. In other words, if I move out in this direction and suddenly I realize, okay, this was not the right way, and now I clearly see I need to be going this way, I haven't put my whole identity over into this choice so that I can easily say, "Whoops, I'm stupid, let's go this way now." And we can go in God's grace and the knowledge that He's with us and He's guiding us. But sometimes we have to move before the Lord's really actually going to be directing our steps. Sometimes He does want us to stay still and be quiet. It takes the discernment of the time and the moment. You know, we can't make up blanket rules for anything like this. This is an adventure, guys. This life is an adventure, and every situation is going to be somewhat different. But in a case like this, when Moses is coming to God, I think he's crying out, he's whining to the Lord, and the Lord is saying, will you quit crying and go do something, and I'm going to show you what I'm going to do through it. And so that's what he does. He basically tells him to go over there, and what he tells him to do is such a simple thing. It's such a simple act of faith. He says, I want you to go out there, and I want you to raise your hand up with a stick in it, and I'm going to do something. You think about such a simple thing to do. I mean, this is one of the greatest miracles recorded in the Bible. We really, you know, apart from what we see in the incarnation of Christ and the salvation of man's heart, to this point and even consequently after that, until the incarnation, this is the greatest miracle of the Bible. This is the most amazing act of deliverance God has done on the earth. He does profound things here through this miracle. And it comes out of such a simple act of faith on Moses' part. He goes and raises his hand up with a stick. One simple little act like that creates this mighty miracle that stands throughout the ages. 3,500 years later, we still talk about it and sit back in awe over what God's done. It's, you know, this is how God does this so often, through simple things. It's how he works salvation into our lives. It's a simple act of faith. He doesn't call us to climb mountains or roll around in glass or do anything else. He says, believe. And we're going, yeah, yeah, and he goes, no, that's it. Believe. Believe that Jesus died for you. Believe that he rose again. Believe that his life covers your life and cleanses you from sin. Yeah, okay, I got that. But what do? No, that's it. Believe. Something simple, a simple act of faith that produces this amazing, mighty miracle of a changed heart, a changed life, a renewed outlook, and a brand new destination. God reveals again then, as he's saying this to Moses, he's revealing again, I'm doing this now because I'm going to gain honor over Pharaoh. I'm going to be glorified through this. So much of what God does, oh, it's inspired by his love and it's inspired by his mercy on us as his children, as the creation that bears his image, but it's also to demonstrate his glory. God wants to be glorified. The fall was a direct challenge to God's goodness. Is God really good? Has God really said that you can't eat this tree? Man, he's not very good. And this is all a result of that challenge to God's goodness. God wants to be glorified. He's going to demonstrate to all creation, to all things, I am good. I am great. And he is good and he is great. So, all right, let's keep reading here. Verses 19 to 20. The angel of God who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud of darkness to the one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other at all by night. Isn't that an interesting thing what God does? There he shows the double-edged sword of who he is. Behold the goodness and severity of God, that double-edge there. He goes and he positions himself with that cloud and that pillar of fire that we talked about in the last chapter, positions himself between Israel and the Egyptians. You know, God does that. He does that. He maneuvers himself in positions where he is between us and our enemy. We never have to fear that. Threats may still loom out there and it may look bad, but God stands between us and destruction. It will not come to us. We will not be destroyed. But notice how it says that the cloud then darkened everything for the Egyptians. That same cloud there that was providing shade and everything for the Israelites as they were going now becomes a darkening force against the Egyptians, but it's providing light through that pillar of fire to the Israelites. So all through the night, as this event unfolds, they've got light and they're able to see. And it's the same thing as I was saying, the goodness and severity of God. It talks about the gospel. Paul says the gospel is the savor of life to those who believe. It's a savor of death. It's a taste of death to those who reject it. It's the same gospel, but it produces these different effects. It's just the interesting way in which it works. So here the hero moves in between his children and the attackers. And we keep reading here to the big deal. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. And the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Okay, that's the big deal. This is one of the greatest miracles. It takes place over two verses, though it's referred to over and over again throughout the scriptures in various places. We won't take the time to track through all of those, but It's one of the greatest miracles of the Bible. It's the parting of the Red Sea. As I said, when this is concluded, I'm not going to sit down and bog down with everybody here on this. Not everybody's going to want to get an in-depth insight into this, but I think you'd be fascinated by some of the theories behind this parting of the Red Sea, the roots of the Exodus, and some amazing archaeological stuff that has been discovered even recently, as in within this last year, that is just profound. I mean, it's just goosebumpy stuff. It was really cool. But anyway, you may not want to hang out for that. But the term Red Sea in the Greek is Yam Suf. There are two, or in the Hebrew, there are two views concerning this. One is the traditional view, which has been around for about 100 years, that we hold to, that most people have held to, that the Suf is talking about, Yam Suf is talking about the Sea of Reeds. The word Suf can be translated as reeds or aquatic, vegetation, thank you. That was the word I was looking for, aquatic vegetation. And so they believe that this was actually taking place on the northern end of the Gulf of Suez, it was in this marshy area where the Nile was draining into the sea, and it was a marshy, brackish area. It was a big swamp, basically. They say that in that area, the water can get up to around 10 feet in depth, and so some of the theories still hold true as to how this could have happened in terms of the water walling up. It doesn't actually say exactly how high of a wall it was either way. And later, as we see how this unfolds, their theory would be supported in the sense that 10 feet of water is a considerable depth of water. There's enough there to do some damage to people who may be in it. So that's been a view that's been held to for quite some time. This is actually referring to the Reed Sea, not necessarily the Red Sea proper and its two canals that come out. And like I said, we'll go into this more in depth later on. The other view, it's more of an emergent view, and that is that it is literally the Red Sea, and that they actually crossed at the region of the Gulf of Aqaba. And that would put Mount Sinai not in the Sinai Peninsula, but actually over in Saudi Arabia. And it's an interesting view all the way around. There's some startling discoveries that have been uncovered there. But one thing that we have to realize is that this is totally different from the Hollywood depiction. When we think of the cross, the parting of the Red Sea, immediately we think of Charlton Heston, or we think of the Prince of Egypt, and we think of Moses walking down to the edge of this big, you know, area of water and holding up his staff and the thing just, you know, in special effects and going up like that and whales swimming through and all of that kind of stuff, and everybody marches through like that. It wasn't like that. And as we read in the text, it didn't happen that way at all. That's great special effects. It's great Hollywood. It makes for, you know, drama. You know, the way it goes here is not necessarily drama the way Hollywood would need it within a two-hour time span, or even like a five-minute time span as they do the special effects. But the way this transpired here, it's dramatic, but it wasn't quite like that. And so you have to think about this. It gives me so much more respect for Moses, because you got to put yourself in Moses' place all of a sudden. You got to start thinking about this. Get into Moses' head for just a moment. There's an army bearing down on you and 2 million people that you convinced to come out here and do this, that God is with you and you're going to go do something for God. And they're coming down at you, and behind you is this sea, and God has told you, okay, quit talking to me about this, now go do something. What he tells him to do is go out and put a stick up in the air, and God's going to do something. You got to think about this. We live on the beach, right? I mean, you know where we live. Think about going down to that beach tonight. It's getting dark or whatever, and go out there with a stick and stand there. And maybe the breeze starts blowing. Okay, that's cool, but that's it. That's all that's going to be happening. That's all that they were going to see in that immediate moment. You're standing there, you got a stick, and your hand in the air, and an army bearing down on you, and nothing really is happening. And an hour, think about the first hour. While you're standing there like this, and looking and hoping, something's going to happen, and the wind's blowing behind you or whatever, but you don't really see anything. Think about how he had to stand there all night long and wait for this miracle to take place. It didn't happen whoo, like that. It was a gradual thing. It was a subtle thing. And there's even actually, in my mind, a greater drama to the subtlety of it, that he had to stand there and wait and wait and wait. And think about how his mind might start playing tricks on him. Well, did I see it go down or did it not go down? I can't really tell. I think it's shallower. I really do. And hoping and against hope that something's going to happen. I have to tell you that if it were me, Israel would still be in Egypt, because I would have been discouraged. After the first hour and I'm standing there and somebody comes up to me and says, what are you doing? I'd lie. I really would. I'd just say, you know, I think better when I do this. I don't know. I just think it's a profound thing about Moses that we see, what God's done in his character, that he stood there through the night while the children of Israel are accusing him of a conspiracy to commit mass murder. And the Egyptians are bearing down on them to take them back by force, back into slavery, and to far worse treatment than they had before. And he's standing at the beach, and he's waiting with a stick all night long. And God comes through, though. That's the most marvelous thing about it. However subtle it was, however long it took, at one point Moses was looking and realizing, man, this is happening. This is a lot shallower than it was before. I think we could even walk across it as it is. But it kept on going, and God continued to show his faithfulness and continued to show his faithfulness until it wasn't just a shallow little area of water. It says they walked across there on dry land. God got it all cleared out of the way for them so that they could go through. Water walled up on either side of them. I think it's a wonderful demonstration of what God can do in our hearts, because this, as I said before, is not the same Moses that headed off for Egypt out of his father-in-law's house. This is a different man. God produced this in him. God developed this faith in him through the things that he faced. And that's what he wants to do with us. He wants to develop that character that will trust him. And even when we stand there at the beach with a stick in our hand, hoping something's going to happen, we'll stand there in confidence, knowing God will come through. He will deliver. He will provide what he said he would provide. Having that kind of confidence in him. Well, anyway, we keep reading the following events, 23 to 28. And the Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. Now, it came to pass in the morning watch. This is kind of like a backtrack here. It's saying, you know, before this part necessarily, this is what was leading up to that. In the morning watch, the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians, and he took off their chariot wheels so that they drove them with difficulty. Yeah, that would do it. And the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. And the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, on their chariots and on their horsemen. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Then the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. Okay, so here it says that God troubled the army of the Egyptians. He's done that over and over in the Old Testament. We'll read those accounts as we go through it. But he does that. It doesn't exactly say how he did it, but he troubled them. He startled them. He stirred them. And so they're taking off. They charge off out into this trough in the sea to go after the children of Israel. And we figure they got about halfway through or three quarters of the way through. It talks about he took the wheels off of their chariot. The Septuagint actually translate that as he bound up the wheels. So it's possible that maybe they got in there and the sand and everything was collapsing under the weight of their chariots and stuff, and they were bogging down. It was difficult to move. It would make more sense that way as opposed to them being completely off, because it would be very difficult to pull a chariot with the wheels off. But either way, when they got in there, then the Lord is troubling them again. He's troubling. So you figure, we don't know. It doesn't give us that. But you can maybe assume that cloud and that fire in some way presented himself before the Egyptians, and they freaked out as they're down in this trough of water. And the language that's used here is fantastic. They say, let's flee from the face of the Israelites. That's the language they would use had they been the ones who were being pursued instead of the attackers. God switched the whole thing around on them. They're all of a sudden fleeing from the face of the Israelites have their back to them. I wonder what they're saying in that. But either way, they're actually, it'll take you a moment and then you'll go, oh. But anyway, they're actually saying, we're going to flee from the face of the Israelites. It's God's completely turned the table, and now the Egyptians are the ones who are trying to flee for their lives, and God, in His glory, is the pursuant. And it's an amazing thing. And so then, of course, the waters come back in here. God tells Moses to stretch out his hand again and let the waters recede back in. This doesn't mean that God had suddenly given Moses power to control water, like the Wonder Twins activating his power. You know, Wonder Twins power activate, form of water, power of whatever. You'd have to watch Saturday morning cartoons back in the 70s to get that, or Cartoon Network now. Some people have even tried to say that it was Moses' faith holding back the water that whole time, and that is, you know, basically the premise of those who'd like to put faith in faith. I don't believe that's it at all. God's just, again, calling for an act of obedience. God works through human agencies. So God says, raise up your hand, and he raises up his hand, and the water comes back in. And so, again, see, we see God's vindicating Moses as well. He's trying to show the children of Israel, this is your leader. This is the one that I've anointed to carry you through there. So pay attention to this, you know, and don't cross him because he'll bring water down on you or something. But no, but the point is that he's accomplishing his will through Moses. He's doing this, and he's doing this through a human agency, as he does so many things in this earth. And it's an order in this case, especially, to vindicate Moses. This is important too because he's going to be the one who will deliver the law to them. Well, let's finish up here, verses 29 to 31. But the children of Israel had walked on dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left hand. So the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt, so the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. So there we get kind of a summary of what we just saw. But somehow, you know, it throws that detail in there. Somehow the sight of those Egyptians dead on the seashore cemented in them the reality that this was a new life for them. This was a new beginning. That they were now a nation who were no longer going to be troubled by Egypt. And they aren't in that sense. They never are under the bondage of Egypt ever again. So it's significant that this new life begins for them, and this great miracle of deliverance comes after the deliverance of the Passover. You know, this miracle of God winning this victory here at the Red Sea comes after the Passover. They work hand in hand. If God hadn't provided the Passover and the miracle of the Passover hadn't taken place, the miracle here would never have happened. They never would have been to the Red Sea. But if they got into the Red Sea and the Lord hadn't done this miracle of providing a safe passage for them, the Passover would have been meaningless, the deliverance of the Passover. They work hand in hand. It's the same with the crucifixion of Christ, his sacrifice on our behalf, and the resurrection. One doesn't work without the other. They have to be hand in hand. We can't say, oh, well, I believe in his death on my behalf, but the resurrection doesn't work for me. They don't work without each other. Without the death, there is no resurrection. Without the resurrection, there's no point to the death. It doesn't have its application to our hearts. So, anyway, we'll pick up here next time. There's a song that results in this that just shoots to the top of the charts, takes up half a passage, adapt a chapter, and we'll deal with that next time as we look at it. So, what did I say, Papter? Chapter? So, whatever. Magyptians, Papters, I just make them up. All right, well, join with me in prayer, if you will. Father, we just thank you for the encouragement that we can draw from your word, and we look at the examples that you left us here with Moses and the children of Israel, and even the Egyptians. We look into your word, Lord. We look into something so old, and yet we can see so readily our own reflection in so many ways. And Father, I just pray that you'll encourage our hearts to believe in you, to trust in you. When you've told us that you'll deliver us, when you told us that you'll bring us home, and you'll bring us safely to the completion of your plan, help us to have that kind of quiet confidence. Continue to build that in us, Lord. Through the things that we even face now, continue to build that character in us as your children so that we can love you with all loyalty, with nothing held in reserve, with all of our hearts. I just pray this for us, Lord. I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.